Hey, y'all. I'm Erin Haynes, the host of The Amendment, a brand new weekly podcast on gender, politics, and power brought to you by the 19th News and Wonder Media Network. You've probably heard the news that this election year, our democracy is at stake. On The Amendment, I'm breaking down what that actually means, specifically for the marginalized folks who depend on our democracy the most. This is a show that dives past the headlines and gets clear on the unfinished work of our democracy. Listen to The Amendment now, wherever you get your podcasts.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University, I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Candace Watt-Smith.
I'm Jenna Spinelli, and welcome to Democracy Works. This week, we are talking with John Iceland and Eric Silver. Both are professors in the Department of Sociology and Criminology here at Penn State. And they are the co-author with Alana Redstone of the University of Illinois of a book called Why We Disagree About Inequality. And this is one of those books where the title really says it all. And the framework or the reason that they propose for why we have these disagreements is a conflict between social justice and social order. And this is something that we've talked about in different capacities on the show before, but I don't think that we've ever really taken a dive as directly on these two approaches to how you view the world, political and otherwise, and why they so often come into conflict.
It's an issue that has some pretty thick research elements to it, but it's also incredibly timely, right? Because no one is disputing that political argument seems particularly fruitless right now, and not to mention ugly, and just serves to kind of drive us farther apart. And their book is trying to say, you know, this is what's going on, and this is what we do about it, right? And so this, you laid it out well, Jenna. There are these two fundamental kind of orientations to how human beings approach these policy questions, and it's social order and social justice. And, you know, we can let them kind of describe them in the interview. But, you know, the point is that these intuitions are, they call them strong and relatively stable. And so it's kind of like a way that you perceive the world in a very basic sense. It's kind of like this is part of your wiring. And anyway, that is the right way, they say, for us to kind of understand why it is we disagree so much. And then, you know, then they get on to what we do about it.
So I would say that this book also kind of, its contribution is that it adds to, you know, a conversation where we usually would talk about left or right, Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal. And it layers on this notion that perhaps even among those kind of divisions, we might think about people's perspectives of the world. Use the word orientation. And on some level, it seeks to help us to understand why we see so much affective polarization and polarization generally. I think the argument here is that on some level, people are talking past each other, mm-hmm. in part because they have different values, that some people, you know, ostensibly value social justice, while others value social order. You know, I'm not sure that I see this as so cut and dry, but I think it's an important contribution in the discussion about how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, I think they don't want to get tied down to, a cut and dried answer of like, you know, is this hardwired? Is it social? Does it depend on circumstances? I think they kind of want to say yes to all that. But the one point that I think is key for them is that a society works better not only when both of these perspectives are operative, but when each side respects the inherent wisdom of the other side. And not to say that, you know, you're not going to fight about it, but the argument is that, you know, it is not good for a society to have either all one or all the other, because it's going to end up being either an unjust or unfree or insufficiently free, insufficiently just society.
The contribution then is something that kind of reminds me of something that Kimberly Crenshaw talked about, is that it is difficult to pinpoint a problem or pinpoint a phenomenon if we don't have a name for it. And so here, what they make an effort to do is to give us a name for this kind of these two basic intuitions around how we should move forward and how we should think about policy and their effects for the way we live among each other. And so for that reason to say, I think it's really interesting that you can look at some number of arguments around racial issues or perhaps transgender issues or sexism and racism, like all of the things. And you can think, okay, well, how is this person coming at this? And maybe one of the ways that they're coming at this is through a lens of social justice or through a lens of social order. And perhaps putting it that way, giving the label, then allows us to have a more constructive conversation about perspectives.
Yeah. And I think, as you said, we'll hear more from John and from Eric about how they define social order and social justice, and also how these sort of core belief sets impact the media that people choose to consume and how they really impact the other aspects of our political lives. So let's go now to the interview with John Iceland and Eric Silver. John Iceland and Eric Silver, welcome to Democracy Works. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So excited to talk with you about your new book, Why We Disagree About Inequality. And I think we'll just start with some definitions. Dive right in. I'll start with you, John, if that's okay. The whole book is based around this social order and social justice framework. I wonder if you could just tell us what that is. You know, listeners may have some notion of what those things represent from how those terms are thrown around in the media. But from your perspective, what do those things mean and how do they fit together in your framing?
Sure. We see these as a distillation of moral and philosophical values that are often in conflict, if not in tension with each other. Essentially, social justice is caring for the vulnerable and freeing them from oppression, whereas social order balances these concerns with social cohesion and social stability. So for those from the social order perspective, they think that these things are necessary for a prosperous society.
Mm-hmm. And Eric, in the media and other places, these notions of social order and social justice are often mapped onto the political spectrum, with social justice being associated more with the left and social order being associated with the right. But in the book, you're clear to say that it's not always as cut and dry as that.
Right. So the social justice side tends to emphasize, as John said, the concern for the well-being of individuals, in particular the weak and the vulnerable. And that's a widely shared moral concern. Even those on the right, or what you might think of as having a social order concern, also care about people, right? And they're all, they have families and they have friends and people are important to them. But they balance that concern against the concern for the order and cohesion of groups. And they have an intuitive sense that order is important for the flourishing of individuals. And so that's one of the places where these two perspectives diverge and end up, you know, in conflict with each other and often talking past each other, failing to recognize that they have some significant overlap in their concerns.
Mm-hmm. And we'll definitely get more into that as we go here. But I wonder if you could talk about the origins of this framework and how you kind of came to think that, oh, wow, I'm picturing like a light bulb moment for one or both of you. Like, oh, this is the thing that explains so many of these conflicts that we have in our society. So I wonder if you could talk more about you know, how you arrived at it. And of course, I know it builds on the work of scholars like Jonathan Haidt and others. But yeah, tell us about how you arrived at this framework.
Sure. Well, I think we see this in general, that this balancing act between social justice and social order is not just a contemporary kind of problem that we're facing in the U.S. today, but it's something that we see in other societies. I think we've seen it historically. There are a number of people who've written about some of this tension. As you mentioned, Jonathan Haidt, Thomas Sowell talked about the conflict of visions, as he termed them. But it's about people through history being concerned about, again, freeing people from oppression, caring for those who need help, versus the concern for social stability and cohesion. This is a constant tension through history. And at different times in history, sometimes we have a little more social order and we could use a lot more social justice. And other times, perhaps it's something where we need a, you know, vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and John has it right as far as what we're concerned with. And the term social order and social justice did come to us as a sort of aha, in the sense that the balance between the ideas is captured in the terms, and that they're terms that are easy to grasp, that you don't have to hear them or get them explained before you understand what they mean. And they are more evocative even than left and right or other terms that academics have used to describe this kind of polarity in people's beliefs. And so part of our goal here is to get these terms out into our field and maybe beyond, because we think that they are a nice heuristic for describing a lot of what's going on in terms of polarization out in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of polarization, I know the two of you are not political scientists by training, so this question might not be in your wheelhouse. Tell me if it's not. But I'm thinking about, the work in political science to suggest that affective polarization or the degree of animosity we feel toward people who hold differing beliefs than us has been on the rise for at least the last decade, if not longer, depending on who you ask. I wonder if how that might play in here. So at times when there's more space or more distance between social order and social justice, is that when affective polarization rise, or would you correlate these things at all?
Yeah, I mean, I would say certainly this book came about because we see this growing polarization, and we saw an urgency to try to talk about it, to understand it. And from our perspective, I think I've long been interested in issues of social inequality. There's been a lot of discussion of these issues. Eric and I have been discussing these issues also in light of political polarization. So as we get together every now and then and talk about them, we felt that we needed to sort of dissect it with this book and talk about it and shine a light on it. And not only just from one perspective, but if we want to sort of address polarization, we got to get people from different sides to understand each other better, to have better conversations about these issues.
And also, I started to realize that each side possesses some wisdom that the other lacks. And that did a lot also to calm my emotional feelings. And I think part of the motivation for a book like this is to try to spread that kind of experience and enable that kind of experience in our own discipline. Maybe we'll get to this at some point, but this is a very unusual book for a discipline like sociology, which tends to lean very hard left. So just the idea of trying to present both sides and to suggest that they have wisdom that the other lacks is an unusual thing, but we think an important thing, not just for the discipline but beyond, and I think it's a way of trying to soothe these intense feelings that exist on both sides.
Yeah. Before we get to some of those conversations within the academy, let's walk through this social order, social justice framework with one of the examples that you use in the book. You open with the summer of 2020, the death of George Floyd, and the protests that followed, and then there's a whole chapter about racial inequality. So walk us through what the social order perspective, what the social justice perspective is, and those points of tension and disagreement between them.
Yeah. So thinking of the George Floyd example, so that puts us in the neck of the woods that is about race and racial inequality and racial injustice. And so the social justice perspective here is, as John said earlier, very tuned into oppression and tends to view racial inequality through that lens. And so the reason there is inequality, that some whites have more than blacks and that Hispanics are somewhere in the middle and that Asians, the reason that there's a distribution of inequality is, from this perspective, oppression. There's something going on, something being imposed on people that's preventing them from achieving the equality they would otherwise achieve. And so that's the social justice perspective kernelized. On the social order side, there's the focus here is on stability and cohesion, group cohesion. And so if you're looking at this from the lens that says everything is ought to be in its place and ought to be balanced against itself, and that you want to create a world that is orderly and stable, well, then you tend to look at inequality as something more natural, that people will have different interests, different abilities, different groups will develop and different cultural tastes and preferences and skills over time, and that those things could lead to different outcomes by race. And that's not a problem from a social order perspective. It's to be expected that you won't have complete equality in everything all the time across all race groups. And you can sense, even as I'm saying that, that's a way of looking at the world as being orderly, even in its inequality. And so these two perspectives come at the same reality and draw from it very different lessons, and therefore have very different policy preferences when it comes to how you change things to become more equal and how far you want to go toward doing that.
Yeah, just to build on what Eric said, I think from the social order perspective, it's not that no change is ever needed, but they want it to see it more incrementally, carefully, so that you don't disrupt things too much. So the concern with the protests after George Floyd wasn't all necessarily just that no change is needed, but as the protests grew and there were some riots across the country, that's when you heard a lot of people from the social order perspective expressing greater concern. It's that, okay, maybe there are some things that need to be done, but this is not the way to do them with riots that are creating a lot of chaos and social disorders, destroying property. So you see a different focal concern there. So when they're reacting to the same sets of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So, John, you mentioned something at the beginning of the conversation that has been going through my mind as we've been talking through this example, and that is sometimes in history there's been more social order than social justice and vice versa. But I think people coming from the social justice perspective would say that there's never been a time in history when we've had more social justice than social order, and that itself is part of the problem.
Well, so I guess, social justice or social injustice manifests itself in different ways in history. So I would say a classic example of when social justice perhaps went too far, again, this is all opinions, is let's say in the French Revolution. You take that at a time in history when there was a very oppressive, sort of essentially kind of a feudal system, a monarchy, and there was a lot of resentment building from below about inequality. And there was it was essentially a social justice movement, right? It had many aims that we could see why they wanted to fight the oppression from above. But they had a sense of that they could sort of construct a society almost from anew. It had very utopian kinds of visions for the future. And in the chaos that came from this complete upheaval of society, you had thousands of people dying. And eventually, social order was only essentially restored once, Napoleon came to power and a monarchy, in a different sense, not as oppressive, was restored. So I think that's an example where people could see that maybe social justice was a time when it went too far, when it tries to think that you can re-engineer society in such a way and do away with every single tradition, some which may be pernicious and harmful, a feudal aristocracy, whereas some elements that are necessary for a society to function at all.
Yeah, I'd add, related to what John is saying, is that it's tempting to think that social justice has been on the back burner or something along those lines. But you could look at the last, and I think that John's example starts in this period. Look at the period since the Enlightenment as the beginning of a social justice movement that has been, you know, spreading in the West for 300 or so years, and that it has made an enormous amount of progress in that direction. One of the characteristics of the social justice orientation is that it wants change fast. It's never satisfied with the current amount of change. Why? Because people are suffering. People are oppressed. How can we just sit still knowing that they're suffering around us? And so it never seems like enough. But if you look at it over the longer arc, and I think Martin Luther King said something like the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice. And if you look at it over the period that we would say, you know, beginning in the late 16 and 1700s, that's a story that's very easy to tell. And so there's a lot of success that those on the social justice side could see and claim. But again, there's something in the tendency to hold that position that wants more and wants faster. And so it tends to feel disappointed even amidst its successes.
Yeah. And we're seeing and certainly have seen all kinds of government institutions wrestle with this, right? What is their role in helping to ease some of these tensions or to adjust those ratios between social order and social justice? I'm thinking about the Supreme Court affirmative action decision over the summer. Mm-hmm. So given what you described earlier about the racial inequality and the, you know, varying perspectives between social order and social justice on that, what do you make of what the Supreme Court is doing here? Do you see that as their effort to, I don't want to say tip the scales because that makes it sound like it's some kind of rigged system, but to intervene in some way to change the equilibrium here.
Well, I would say the debate about affirmative action, you know, has that we can learn a lot by using the social justice, social order framework in the sense that affirmative action was devised as a way to try to engineer equity, equal outcomes across groups, which is a central concern for social justice. That's how they see fairness, right? So to the extent that we don't have people equally represented in institutions such as Ivy League universities or highly ranked public universities, you know, the defendants, I guess, in the case were Harvard and University of North Carolina. So to the extent that we don't see groups equally represented, that means that we have an unfair system. And so that we need to actively try to achieve equity. Those from the social order perspective, though, are wary of attempts to engineer equal outcomes. And also they have a different sense of what fairness is. They don't see fairness necessary, not just in terms of equal outcomes, but are people treated equally in a process? Because they see this is the way you promote social cohesion, essentially. And so that's why they tend to be against affirmative action, because it's not, well, it gives, points to people based on their background, in this case, race. So that's where we see the tension between social justice and social order. It's about they perceive fairness in very different ways.
Right. And beyond that, the decision, or beyond just the details of the decision, policies like affirmative action, while they are aimed at increasing justice by, as John said, increasing equity, they do so at a cost. And we may not find it pleasant to recognize that cost, but something like an affirmative action policy is a zero-sum game, right? And so some people have to be treated unfairly for other people to be treated better than fairly. And that creates disorder. It creates resentment. It causes people to lose their sense of legitimacy in institutions. If the institutions that are supposed to be running things are designed to treat some people unfairly in order to help others, this is destabilizing from a social order perspective. And the social order folks feel that in the same way the social justice folks feel the suffering of those who currently have less for reasons that are historical and outside of their control. So you can look at the Supreme Court decision as if you're thinking of social order and social justice as a way of trying to rebalance this. Now, of course, the decision doesn't produce a solution. Maybe we could talk about that later, but it's it definitely is an attempt to, or one of the results of it could be to increase people's sense of the legitimacy in the system if it's treating everyone fairly, which would promote order. Yeah. In the system.
So one thing that comes up fairly often when we're talking about these kinds of things in a political sense is the notion of asymmetry, right? So things are not, people are accused of both sidesism, or that's kind of you're equating, you know, you're saying that people who rushed the Capitol on January 6th are on the same plane as people who participated in the riots in the summer of 2020. So, you know, people, as I said, in the political space are trying to grapple with how much this asymmetry should matter or be taken into consideration. I wonder if you thought about that as you were weighing the, you know, social order, social justice framework.
So we're not saying that anything goes, right? That's not our position. At the same time, I think we lean toward, let's hear it out, you know? I think the idea that some perspectives are too dangerous to hear is itself a very dangerous idea. And so I think we would lean toward, you know, not worrying less about both sidesism and worrying more about suppressing points of view because they are somehow problematic. I'm using air quotes again. And that would be more of a concern. At least I'll speak for myself, for me, and maybe John has a thought about it too.
Well, I think you're right, Jenna, that there is a lot of whataboutism, you know, in debates. They point to the worst actors on the other side often, which again isn't very helpful in understanding the typical viewpoint of someone on the other side versus the extreme person on the other side. And I think asymmetries occurred in different ways in different spaces. Sometimes you'll have in some spaces where you see sort of, let's say, views on the right dominate, maybe in some state legislatures, and in other places, more social justice voices dominate. So you'll always have some of that. But, you know, I certainly agree with Eric that we should leave enough room in all spaces just to hear different viewpoints, and especially sort of the reasonable versions of the different sides are out there, you know.
Well, and one of those places, as you were mentioning earlier, where you might say leans too heavily on social justice in your conception is the academy, or, you know, obviously every university is different and it's difficult to paint them with a broad brush, but folks certainly have, and it's generally that, you know, they are more oriented toward justice. And I don't think you would disagree. You make the case for more viewpoint diversity. So yeah, talk about that. One, like, what, again, viewpoint diversity is a term that often gets thrown around a lot. So how do you define it? And then, you know, what would you like to see happen within higher education?
Well, I could start briefly, at least. Part of it is that me and Eric come from the standpoint is that each side has some wisdom that the other can learn from. And actually, the tension between the two is often a good thing, and too much of one or the other in a given circumstance doesn't necessarily produce the right outcome. So we discussed that earlier on. So I think this is where in the university where it's often useful to have different viewpoints, because if we want to increase our understanding of this world, you need to have people push back on each other. This happens, you know, in the hard sciences when a new theory comes up. And you know, we had Einstein's relativity built on challenge something from the past, and then we had quantum mechanics. Not that I know much about these fields that sort of disprove what was before. But likewise, in the social sciences, when we're trying to learn more about our world, it's important to have ideas challenged. And sometimes they're challenged unsuccessfully, and that's perfectly fine. But I think this is where, if we see one of the goals of the university is to increase our understanding of our world, this is where different viewpoints is helpful and shouldn't be, you know, viewed in a negative light in that way. And also, just the last thing I'll say is, when I teach my own classes on social problems, I'd like to have students at least consider different viewpoints, because this helps develop their critical thinking skills. That's what we're all about in the liberal arts. And of course, they might come to whatever conclusion they come to, and that's perfectly fine, and that's what we expect of our students. But I don't like hand-feeding them that this is necessarily the truth, when it could be an issue which is contested to some extent.
Yeah, I too teach the value of viewpoint diversity. I consider it a value. And in fact, I consider it extremely troubling that the term is troubling, right? Because viewpoint diversity simply means let's allow each other to have different viewpoints and let's not leave the table because of that. And that some people seem to have recast viewpoint diversity as some kind of Trojan horse for conservatism is, I don't know what to call it. It's a PR campaign that is not grounded in what seemed to me like core values of a democratic society. I don't think you can villainize viewpoint diversity and maintain democratic deliberation.
So just curious there, Eric, you said the word balance several times, but I didn't hear you use the word compromise. I wonder, do you see balance and compromise as separate, and how, if at all, do you see them fitting together?
Yeah, compromise is a fine word to me. I think people don't like it. It sounds like defeat. And so I tend to avoid it. But in the end, if you've got people who are strongly committed to their different points of view, sometimes you have to just trust that each side possesses a wisdom the other lacks and be willing to compromise and hopefully not see it as a devastating defeat.
I'll only add to what Eric said that so it's important to, you know, to come to seeing the wisdom in the different sides. And I think what this can also help, and we've talked about this before, is we're very concerned about polarization in society. So we want to find a way to have good and productive conversations about these social problems. And so we're hoping that our book contributes to that. And again, that doesn't mean that on every issue the answer is always in the exact middle. Sometimes on some issues, we do need a lot more social justice. There's too much sort of hierarchy and structure that is not helpful. And then other times we might find the opposite. But let's have a conversation about these things. That's what we think's important.
Well, your book is very readable, very easy to help understand some of these problems that we face. I hope listeners will pick it up and give it a read. And I thank both of you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Jenna, for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Jenna.
Well, thank you, Jenna. That was really a really terrific interview. And, you know, there's one point I think I want to get back to. But I wanted to just kind of start with, we mentioned it in the front part about this question of where do these differences come from? You know, to talk about them as intuitions, it does really kind of, you know, brings to mind the idea that these are somehow innate or that we kind of are born with them or that they are, you know, dispositions, right? But, you know, it's pretty obvious, I think, and I don't think they're going to dispute this, that when you look at people's circumstance in life, you kind of get people tend to line up one way or the other, right? So if you are wealthy and well-established and your life is going well, then obviously you're going to have an incentive to keep things the same, to keep things stable. And it would seem to me that that's going to kind of make it you more likely to prefer social order. And conversely, if you've experienced society in a way in which you've experienced oppression, whether you be, LGBTQ or whether you be, African-American or, some kind of other group, a poor person, you name it, you're going to have a much different experience of stability and of order. And so, of course, you're going to want to be more open to the social order ideal. And so I think this question of, where does this come from? What does it mean? And how do we rightly understand it? You know, it is complicated, but I think it's essential to kind of figuring out, what we do about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a social dimension to this. And the thing is that there is no one person who is always located in a position of power or on the top of hierarchies every single time, nor are there people who are located on every, bottom hierarchy every single time. So, we've all experienced power and powerlessness, but we also know that there are some people who have greater experiences of oppression, of exclusion, of marginality. And we might expect those people to be more likely to align with the social justice framework. And just as you said, you know, those who find themselves in more powerful positions where the status quo is looking real good for them, we might expect them to feel, be more aligned with, have a greater probability of being aligned with the social order. And I just also want to say, though, that this is one of the reasons why higher education is so important, is because college, especially, and I've really been trying to think about this, and I'm looking for someone to tell me another case or where I'm wrong, is that college is one of the few places where you are shoulder to shoulder with people who are just not like you, mm-hmm. where people show up from, I mean, I have the good fortune of working at Duke. And when I was at Penn State too, there are people from all over the world, from all walks of life. And so that education component serves to broaden people's horizons and perspectives. I'm only saying this because during the interview, there's this kind of notion that academics and academia leans liberal and leans toward the social justice idea. But I think that's partially because when people are exposed to the circumstances of other people's lives in real way and find themselves in proximity or in allyship with people that are not like them or people that have faced marginalization, they are more likely to note and notice the unfairness of it all and the contradictions of meritocracy, of liberty and egalitarianism and all of the things that we say that we want and don't necessarily have. I had a little bit of hard time, or let me say this, I really have to wrestle with this kind of idea that social order and social justice can be put on an equal moral footing, at least in a real world way. I can think abstractly about it, but when our examples are George Floyd and Me Too, and the two intuitions here for me are not morally equivalent because one perspective tends to be held by people who are people with power, and the other perspective tends to be held by people without power. So yeah, I guess the last thing I would say, and I don't normally go on like this, but I cannot help myself, is that for me, I think actually this kind of, these two ideas are not, social order and social justice are not as cut and dry.
I think that's a really good transition to the one other point that I really want to get to, and it's something that all three of us kind of highlighted in the interview. Both you and I, Candace, were like, Jenna, that's a really good question about when is the social justice intuition, the motivation, conception, when has that ever been ascended, right? I mean, it's all about, you know, social structures are about power, and people with power create them, right? And they create them in ways to sustain their own power. I mean, there's nothing weird or, you know, I mean, that's not a lefty thing to say. That's just empirical. That's the way it works. Mm-hmm. And so when Jenna said, when was it the social justice conception ever ascended? And they said the French Revolution, and both of us are like,
what?
Wait a minute. You know, I mean, like, you know, it's not, I mean, there's an argument there, you know, you could say, okay, I guess so. But first of all, I'm not even sure if it works on its own because, you know, there was really, I mean, is social justice the same as just this kind of violent and really violent retribution against the ruling class? Is that what social justice is? I'm not sure. But even so, even if you just accept it, it's 250 years ago, right? And if that's the case, if that's the shining example you point to, well, then that kind of bespeaks the fact that social justice is really kind of always, you know, a leg down in this world we live in.
Yes, agree. I think for me, there was an implied notion, and maybe not intended by John and Eric, but the example was one that highlighted notions of disorder. And so then it was, my question was, is there an idea that social justice and social disorder, go together? And similarly, then on the other side, does social order and social injustice always go together? So I think for me, there just needed to be a little bit more care and nuance around the subject of social justice and social order, and the extent to which they overlap, the tensions that are there. But, and that I appreciate the discussion of tension, but I wish for just a little bit more nuance on both sides. I was trying to think of an example of when social justice has been like ascendant. And I thought maybe it would be like Reconstruction. But even then, radical Reconstruction did turn formerly enslaved people into Congress people. And that was a lot of change in a little bit of time. And okay, yes, then we ended up with Jim Crow for another 100 years. But my point is that there are moments when a lot of change can be made in a little bit of time. And if people stick with it, right, if people had stuck with Reconstruction, we might be in a totally different place than we are today.
Well, I mean, I think what you can take away from this conversation is that this book is full of ideas and concepts and, you know, ways of framing, you know, very topical issues that are really thought-provoking. And, you know, I mean, I don't know that you know, you and I, Candace, came down exactly the same on anything except maybe the French Revolution. but that's to the book's credit, right? So thanks to Eric and John for coming on for the terrific book. And for Jenna for the interview. I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Candace Watt-Smith for Democracy Works. Thanks for listening.
Democracy Works is a collaboration between the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU Public Media. Our editors are Michael Klein, Chris Kugler, Mark Stitzer, and Clint Yoder. Editorial review by Emily Reddy. Additional production support from Andy Grant and Christine Allen. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating or review in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Democracy Works is a member of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about our podcast collective devoted to democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.